Well, we've been dealing with some issues that are vital to us in our search for unity. I'm convinced that we really have an attitude problem. And until we get our attitude about unity corrected, all we're going to be doing is continuing to stamp out forest fires or grass fires. Just stamp this one out and stamp another one out. What we really need to do is go back and get some principles that will help us to be peace people rather than strife people. And each day we've been giving one simple principle that would be a concrete example or concrete principle regarding this general theme of how to differ without dividing. We noticed the first day that diversity is part and parcel of Christianity, and that it's our task to bring unity out of diversity and thereby establish our identity as followers of Christ. And then yesterday we talked about that unity consists both of basis and atmosphere. Ephesians 4, 1 through 6, the basis being one God, one Lord, one faith, one baptism, the ones there, verses 4 through 6. And then the atmosphere being lowliness, meekness, gentleness, patience, all these qualities there, earnestly desiring the peace and the unity of the Spirit in the bond of peace. It takes both basis and atmosphere. We've emphasized and majored in basis without the atmosphere having the proper place, and as a result, we've become a splintering group and a fragmented fellowship. Well, today, let me mention this third principle, and that these aren't the only ones, of course, and these may not even be the most pressing, but I think that they are appropriate. This is simply that love is that that binds everything together in perfect harmony. That's Colossians 3:14. Love does it. Not like, and not being alike. Now, if you want to know what really binds together in perfect harmony, it's love. Not liking somebody. You don't just get together and stay together with those that you like, nor do you just get together and stay together with those that you are alike. If you do, you're not anything different from the world. Jesus says, well, people in the world act like that. They love those that love them. They say hello to those that say hello to them. But what credit is that to you? He said, I'm telling you to love your enemies. And I guarantee you, some of your worst enemies may be some of your brethren. Love them. And I'd like to give three simple handles on how do you go about loving somebody in the body. How do you go about loving somebody in tangible terms? Number one, do not speak or write against another person. And if you feel like you must speak against them or you must write against them, do not do it until you have met with them either by phone or face-to-face and expressed your disagreement with them face-to-face. You'll be surprised how many differences will be corrected just by checking with the source. I got written up once on the divorce issue, and I was listed with those people that endorse homosexuality, bestiality, incest. He listed me with all that hideous list of sins. I went to the man, I called him up, and I said, can we meet? I'll come to Memphis, I'll drive over there, and I need to sit down with you. He said, yes, come on. So I made an appointment, went to his office, sat down, and I asked him this question first. I said, have you ever read my book? And this crimson glow overtook his countenance. He said, well, I thumbed through it. Not only had he not called me, he hadn't even read the book. Now, brethren, that's wrong. So let me say, first of all, here's how you love somebody that you differ with. And you know, you just may be really at odds with them. And in the church, you may just think they're terribly wrong. Just simply go to them. If you've got to say something about it, your conscience compels you, let it be a safeguard to just go to them first and sit down with them and say, now let me make sure that what I'm hearing you say is this. And you know what? About 9 times out of 10, you're going to find out that's not even what he's talking about. Okay, so don't talk about anybody or write about anybody, at least until you've checked with the source. Number two, pray for that person, even after you've checked the source. Pray for him. I find It is impossible for me to hate somebody that I pray for. Now, if I really want to hate somebody, I make it a point, don't ever pray for him. I ain't about to pray for him. I want to hate you. Yeah, if you pray for him, you've had it. You might as well forget about hating him. You can't hate him. You can't treat him bad if you pray for him. Now, I don't mean you pray this kind of a prayer. Lord, help that knucklehead to see things my way. That's not it. Pray, God, give him a good day. Bless his wife. Bless his children. Give him good health. And help him to be the kind of man that you can use. That's the kind of prayer I'm talking about. Thirdly, do something kind for him. That's why mamas love their babies so. They're always doing something for them. They went to death's door for them. They fed them for months and years, you know. They've waited on them. They've changed their diapers. They've done all these kind things for their babies. That's why they love them. So I'm saying that if you really want to love those that you're different from, don't ever talk about them behind their back. Don't ever write about them until at least you've checked with the source. Then pray for them regularly, and then do something nice for them whenever you have the opportunity. That's a good way to spread love and to bring about unity. Now, having seen yesterday the first two of these major principles that we said were the major areas that were causes of friction whenever Crossroads ministries or campus ministries, but in particular the Crossroads ministries, come into established congregations, those two principles or two areas were these: shepherding and evangelizing. And we learned that pretty well we in the established churches have pretty well under-shepherded, and if there's a conflict there, they're over-shepherding. So we're turning at a real soul speed, and here come these, you know, just running and gunning, and that's been the problem there, intensity of shepherding or counseling. The same thing can be said of the difference or the friction created in the areas of evangelism. Probably intensity of evangelizing is also at the base of this friction. We've evangelized by proxy. And there, if they're doing anything about it that's not like what we're doing, it's that they're overzealous, that they're overextending themselves to the extent that they're using many times coercion and are insisting that everybody be exactly like they are. That's something that they have done, and I think they need to correct that. But now, the third and fourth, we're going to spend most of our time on the third area. That is, how do you go about developing a mature morality in converts? The problem has always been a problem in the church. This is no new problem because Crossroads campus ministers have moved into your congregation. That's not the origin of it. This was the problem back in the first century. Do you know what was the big, big problem in the church in the first century? It was a disagreement between honest men, God-fearing men, a disagreement about how do you go about bringing mature morality into the lives of people. That was the big one. We'll notice in a moment a bit more. But these two attitudes, or these two approaches, I think also have to do with intensity, or the rate at which the two try to go in order to bring about the development of mature morality. I'm going to just say these two things here to kind of focus it so you'll know where I'm going. The established church, to a great degree, in trying to bring people to morality, has pretty well depended upon absorption. We've allowed the new converts to just absorb the moral qualities that we think they ought to have. Whereas the campus ministers, they depend upon injection. Now, you know the difference between absorption and injection. It's a matter of intensity. When you go to the doctor and he says, well, you're pretty close to being well. It's not all that serious. I'm just going to give you some penicillin in the mouth. You take two of these, you know, every two or three, five, 4 hours, and come back and see me in a month. If the doctor gets real wide-eyed and says, man, you are in trouble, he says, you're going to need an injection. And he brings out this huge needle, you know, it looks like a diesel exhaust, and he sticks it in you. He knows there's problems there. Well, that's the kind of two things, one by absorption, which we've been doing in the established churches, the other by injection. Now, the established churches, the circumstances that have allowed us or have encouraged us to approach the development of morality by absorption are these. There are about three. Number one, the rate of conversions in most established congregations is slow enough that we have been able to take those new converts into our fellowship without their threatening the moral stability of the church. Now, do you understand what I said there? That the rate of the conversions, we just haven't been converting all that many people. Had we been converting, say, 1,000 people a year, bringing them into the church, there would be a problem. But when you convert only 5 or 10 or 15 people a year and bring them into the church, the number is low enough that you don't really have to worry about the detrimental effect that their immorality is going to have on the stability of the moral climate of the church. So we've been able to bring them in, and that low rate has been such that it has allowed us to not, it just doesn't rock the boat. Here's another thought, too, that low rate has also given the new convert plenty of examples that, you know, the church is large enough, each one of the new converts can have 3 or 4 families or 5 or 6 families to serve as role models, so they just kind of come in among us and slowly begin to absorb the morality of the church. We don't upset them, they don't upset us, it's just a matter of slow absorption. But the second thing, not just the rate of conversions, the difference that the converts have to travel, the ones that we're converting in the established church, the distance that they have to travel to become like us just isn't all that great. Now, what I mean by that is that we tend to convert people who are nearly like us. We go out and look for people who are pretty well, they're morally upright, and we say, and you've heard this said time and again, man alive, that man, we ought to go convert him. He's such a fine, upstanding citizen. He's this, and he's a good businessman. What in the name of common sense are we talking about? I know what we're talking about. We're saying, and we're betraying our motive. Our motive is, he'll be a great benefit to the church, so go get him. And so as a result, unconsciously, the kind of people that we've been converting to us are so near like us that we just really haven't had much of a problem of bringing them to be like us. There's a third thought that I need to say, though, and that is, not only is that true, but it's also true, not just that they're not very far from us, but it's also true that not only that we have not reached very far down in the heap, but something else must be said, and that is that we ourselves, in the established church today, in so many locations, we have not escaped all that far from the heap. Now, don't take that as a put down. I'm just saying that the standards of morality in the present day established church many times are shockingly low. Materialism is rampant in the church today in the 20th century. Terry Rush spoke of it just a few moments ago. Materialism is perhaps out of control in some congregations. We're not all that different from the world. We seek for things just like the world seeks for it. How do you tell a difference between the world and the church in terms of materialism? Do we have all that much less than what they've got? No, we're right there in the middle of all of it with them. Do we put all that much less emphasis upon having material possessions? No, not all that much. You look at it, we're not all that far removed from the scene of the world. And consequently, there's another reason why they don't have to travel very far to be like us, because we're a lot like them. And then you look at drug abuse and sexual immorality and the divorce rate and the rate of unmarried mothers, and all of this is kind of catching up with us, and we're just not all that much different from the world. So I say that that's one reason why we are able to bring in people without all that much trauma when they're brought into our assemblies from the world. Now, but the campus ministries are faced with another problem, and they're using an injection method to try to get morality into these people. And this is in the opposite of what we've just talked about the established church, whereas the rate of conversions in the established church, that doesn't cause any rocking of the boat, but the rate of conversions in the campus ministries definitely does cause a rocking of the boat. You can't bring 50 or 75 or 100 new converts out of the raw world without it causing some trauma in the body. And that's exactly what's happening. The number or the rate of conversions that are being experienced in the campus ministries are sufficient, or is sufficient, that it's causing a trauma and it's causing some problems. Not only is that true, that the rate is high enough, But the distance that most of those new converts have to travel who are converted on campus is significantly wider or much more than is normally experienced. The distance they have to travel is great enough, by the way, that it's going to cause some problems. So the number of conversions causes problems, and the source from which those converts are coming is pretty raw. They've been living in the world, they've been cohabiting, they've been on drugs, they're immoral. That's got to affect the moral climate as they're brought in such great numbers. Okay, so there's the problem. How do you go about solving it? How do you bring people to a mature morality? The different approaches are bound to create friction. First of all, let's look for just a moment at three levels of morality that exist in the world today. Number one, there's an animal level. The animal level. In 1 Peter 4:3, Peter said, the time passed, you know, you've lived like this long enough. He says, quit doing like the Gentiles like to do. And Peter gives this description of it in chapter 4. Let the time that's passed suffice for doing what the Gentiles like to do, living in licentiousness, passions, drunkenness, revels, carousings, and lawless idolatry. He says that, you know, that's long enough. And in another place, he says, like irrational animals that are fit only to be caught and killed. He talks about this animal-type morality. Then there's another kind of morality. What's the next level of morality above the animal morality? What would you say it would be? It's the slave level of morality. People who are doing what's right, but because of some exterior force. People who are doing what's right, but only because the police are looking over their shoulders. How many of us here today live by a slave-level morality? Well, it's probably mixed up a bit. I suspect there's a little animal in some of us, and there's a little slave in some of us, and maybe the third level, that of the free man. But Christianity, Jesus Christ, wants us to be free men. How do you bring men into that freedom? Into free man morality. For the slave level of morality, write down these verses, Galatians 4, 1 and 2, Colossians 2, 20 through 23. We're not going to go into this in detail, but I want you to have that as your background. Galatians 4, 1 and 2, Colossians 2, 20 through 23. There's the third level, the free man morality, Colossians 3, 1 through 4, 6. Colossians 3, 1 through chapter 4 and verse 6. It talks about the free level. If you have been raised with Christ, seek the things that are above where Christ is, seated at the right hand of God. And he talks about the freedom. The book of Galatians says, for freedom you've been set free. Only don't use your freedom as a cloak for licentiousness or for ungodliness. These three levels. Now, bringing a person to the free morality, how do you do it? I'll guarantee you do it with much fear and trembling in some respects. There was a man, I marked this out, I wasn't going to tell it. But let me tell it, it'll illustrate it. You may think I'm a heretic, but it'll illustrate it anyway, I don't want to hide from you. While we were overseas, a man that I had taught and we'd baptized, and he told me one day, I was sitting in his home studying, he said, Jim, he said, I've quit getting sloshed. And he meant by that, I've quit getting drunk. But he said, I want you to tell me, what must I do with that can of beer in my icebox? Well, I played like I didn't even hear him. I started looking for something else. I just left Middle Tennessee, been raised over there, you know what? I left over there and went to New Zealand, and here this fellow didn't have any more respect for me than to ask what should he do about that can of beer in his icebox. Well, I tried to ignore him, but you know, he wouldn't let me. He said, I want you to tell me, what will I do about the can of beer? Shall I drink it or shall I not drink it? Well, I tell you, I'd prayed the Lord give me wisdom for just such times as that. I said to him, I said, you really wish I would make that decision for you, don't you? You really wish I would tell you to drink it or don't drink it. And if I had told him to drink it, I think he would have. If I had told him don't drink it, I think he would have obeyed that. I said, listen, you're going to have to make that decision for yourself. You're going to have to get the Bible, sit down, find out what Christ wants you to do about it, and then do it. Well, boy, I then swallowed a real big swallow, and I thought, what in the world have I said? But I was right. Now that may make some of you nervous, but brethren, I knew I had to do something in New Zealand that would cause those brethren not only to do right while I was there, I had to figure out what it took to cause them to do right after I'd gotten on the boat and left. And you can make sure he doesn't smoke behind the barn while you're there watching him, but that doesn't amount to a hill of beans. What I had to find out was, how do you get him to do what's right when you've gone home and left him? He's just there by himself. Well, I'll tell you what, he grew 5 inches. It's as though he just jumped up right there. He grew 5 inches. I thought I knew what he was going to do. But listen, before you can tell a person that, you know what 3 things have to be done? Don't you tell that to everybody. Before you can tell a person and entrust him with that kind of responsibility, number one, you've got to make dead sure you've converted him to Jesus Christ and not just to the church. You've got to convert him to Christ. You've got to make sure that Christ is the Lord of that man's life. You've got to make sure that he's going to jump over whatever it takes. He's going to climb whatever mountain. He'll swim whatever river. He'll overcome whatever obstacle it takes to get his life in line with Jesus Christ. Once you've converted the man to Christ, only then can you begin to think about telling him, this is the kind of, you can do this. Secondly, you've got to set the right example in front of him. He knew I didn't smoke. He knew I didn't drink. He knew I didn't approve of it. He had never seen me drink. He had never heard me preach against it, but he just simply knew I didn't drink. So you've got to set the right example for him. Paul said, be imitators of me as I am of Christ. Paul could say that. I could say to that man, you know, you need to find out what Christ wants you to do about it. Get the word. But then I could say to him, look at my life, and you'll get some indication as to how you're supposed to live. And then thirdly, you're supposed to just give him some time. Give him time. Well, how much time? It didn't take me but 2 weeks to know that was wrong. Well, that's good for you. Great. I'm thankful for you. It may take him 4 months. Are you willing to give him some time? Listen, convert him to Jesus Christ, set the right example before him, and then give him some time. That's the way to bring people to a mature morality. But the objection is, that takes too much time. Now, the present abuse by campus ministries, I think, lies not in their desire to bring people to moral living. I love them for that. I respect them for that. I can appreciate and identify with them for that. The abuse to which their ministry is opened is the abuse of method. What is the method? Look, and I hope you can see this principle. The campus ministers among us today, in their zeal to bring people to Christ and in their zeal to bring them to mature morality, have fallen into the same trap that the first century Judaizing teachers fell into when that horde of Gentile, stinking Gentile converts came into the church and was about to sink the thing because the morality that they had was not any morality, it was an immorality. They didn't have any moral background. The Jew had 14 centuries of moral awareness, moral consciousness, and respect for law and respect for morality. Here came these Gentiles, and at first it really wasn't any problem, because the rate was not high enough that it mattered. And you don't find the problem arising then. You know when you find the problem coming in? When the rate of conversions of these people who had such a long distance to travel to become morally upright people, when both of these things figured in as factors, it tripped something in those Jewish people and they panicked. They said, if we're going to survive, we're going to have to make them do what? We better tell them to be what? Be circumcised and keep what? Keep the law of Moses. Boy, the Apostle Paul, everywhere he went, trying to convert people to the Lord, and he was the apostle to the Gentiles. Right behind him came these Judaizers that said, okay, we're going to have to do it and do it right now, and we've got to shape these people up and shape them up now. Tell them to keep the law of Moses, circumcise them, and bind this legislation upon them. But he says, and he discounts it, he says, no, that's not the right method. If with Christ you died to the... That's beginning in verse 20 of chapter 2 of Colossians. If with Christ you died to the elemental spirits of the universe, why do you live as if you still belong to the world? Now, what do you think he's talking about? What do you think Paul is talking about? He says, look, if you really have been converted, why are you still living like you haven't been converted?
you would almost expect him to say, why are you still drinking? Why are you still carousing? Why are you still worshiping idols? All these things. Why are you doing? That's not what he's talking about. What he says next indicates what he means. Why do you submit to regulations? Do not handle. Do not taste. Do not touch that. Referring to things which all perish as they're used according to human precepts and doctrines, or traditions and doctrines. These look good, he says. They have an appearance of wisdom in promoting rigor of devotion and self-abasement and total commitment. That's exactly what you would have to translate this if you were translating it into present-day campus ministry language. Let's be honest about it. These have an appearance, all these regulations and the customs and the precepts and all these things that have been surmised as being good, and they may be fine in themselves, but he says they have indeed an appearance of wisdom in promoting total commitment or rigor of devotion or self-abasement and severity to the body. But listen to this. They are of no value in checking the indulgence of the flesh, none whatsoever. Well, can we avoid that trap? Well, I don't know whether we will or not, but I think we better. Not just the campus ministries. May I urge them, please don't approach morality on the basis that you can legislate it. Please don't think that you can cause a person to be put into your framework and conform to your pace, or conform to some standard that you may have met or set. You may have met this thing. You may have quit smoking on a six-day basis. Fine. Give the brother that you convert the freedom to make it so that it may be 2 weeks before he quits. Don't do like someone did just the other day, and this came from the person who heard it. They told him, there's sin in your life, brother, and you've got 1 week to get it out or you're gone. Now, brethren, that's absolutely demonic. Simon Peter wouldn't have lasted a week in that kind of an environment. And let me just be real frank, neither would you. And let me be real humble, neither would I. No, I'm not being humble. Let me just be real realistic. I wouldn't last a week in that kind of an environment. Well, okay, how are you going to go about it? How are you going to go about it? Well, like I said, these three things, convert them to Jesus Christ, set the right example before the new convert, and then give him time. How much time? Well, as much time as he needs. After all, what are you doing? Well, you're trying to bring him to a mature morality. Ask the question, how long did it take Jesus to bring Simon Peter to a mature morality? 3 years? No, wasn't even 3 years. You mean it wasn't that long? Oh, no, that just kind of touched the hem of the garment. Peter bumbled and fumbled, and he was still fumbling about 14 or 15 years after he was converted. He made the terrible mistake of discrimination, and the second chapter of Galatians talks about it. Paul had to go and confront him to his face. Aren't you glad that we didn't write Simon Peter off 14 years earlier? Convert them to Jesus Christ. Hold Jesus Christ up in front of them, and so live your life that you demonstrate the life of Christ, and then give those people some time. And then let me say this. Please fight for the freedom of each person to grow up at his own pace by the Spirit of Jesus Christ, because sanctification comes by the Spirit, not by legislation. And I address that to the campus ministries, but I address it also to those of us in the body of Christ in general, in the established churches. Will you please fight for the right of every individual to grow up in the Lord into a mature morality at his pace that the Lord sets for him according to his Spirit? Okay, let me close now with this. The fourth area of friction is the area of fellowship or disfellowship. In the established church, first, let me mention how we normally do disfellowshipping. Most of the disfellowshipping that most of us have seen has been of this kind. The elders write a letter to the person who has already left 6 months ago and try to find him and we track him down from this location to that, and we send please forward and get this letter to him so that they can recognize officially what he's already done 6 months earlier, in fact. And so they say, in essence, okay, we are disfellowshipping you. We no longer recognize you as a part of this body. What else is new? They haven't been a part of that body for 6 months. Is that the majority of the way? That's the problem with the majority of the kind of disfellowshipping we've done. The campus ministers are not confronted with that particular problem. What their problem is how to discipline those people who want the love and the fellowship and the inclusion in the body, but they're still hanging on to their drugs and they're sleeping around and all that they're doing, but they want that inclusion in the body. And these brethren in the campus ministries are being confronted with, how do you discipline those people to make sure that they quit living like Satan? That's their problem. And you know which one is more biblical? The problem that confronts the campus ministries and their effort to deal with it is more biblical than the problem that we've got and the way that we're dealing with it. That's right. Here's where the friction comes. The friction comes at the point when the campus ministers are the ones who do the disfellowshipping instead of the elders. When the campus ministers usurp the authority or the place of the elders, who are the shepherds of the flock, whenever they take it upon themselves to describe and to proscribe what is to be done and when it is to be done and to whom it is to be done, and they take it upon themselves to make that decision, in effect, you have given them one more reason and way in which to make a movement within a movement. And, of course, that always creates friction and will eventually end in division. This decision must be made by the elders of the body of Christ, and it cannot be made unilaterally by the campus ministers. Otherwise, you've got, in effect, two sources of discipline, and you cannot have that without having friction. And let me just urge the campus ministers to make sure that the elders know enough about the life of these new converts that they go to them and say, now, my father, as they would talk to an elder, or my brethren, this man, we've been working with him for 6 months. He's showing no signs. He's bringing reproach upon the church. We feel like that some action needs to be taken. The elders then would get intimately involved and with that person and talk to him and say, how are you coming and what's happening? And they would know, you know, the time is now, and we're going to have to withdraw fellowship from you. But brethren, I'm just simply maintaining it cannot be done unilaterally by the campus ministers. It must be done by the elders of the body, and the exclusion must be from the whole body and not just from the campus ministry. Well, that's an area of conflict, and we need to address it. These four areas, then, I'll leave for your consideration. Let's make sure that we provide a broad enough base for shepherding and that the campus ministers turn over to the whole body those who need to be shepherded, who are converted. Let's make sure that we provide in the area of shepherding the proper balance. In evangelism, let's make sure that we all are involved, but at whatever place your talent is. And let's not be exclusive in it. Let's be inclusive. And then on the basis of morality, how do you bring people to a mature morality? You bring it to them by converting them to Christ, living it in front of them, and giving them some time. You don't do it by legislating it. And then this fourth principle, make sure that the elders have the right and have a part in the withdrawing of fellowship. I really appreciate your coming. Not because of just my class, I believe that we're able at this point to make a mark for some unity. I think we're ready to start acting like somebody that's a bit above us, and that one is the Lord Jesus Christ. Let's just start acting like him. Okay, may God bless you, and it's my prayer that we'll bring about that unity.